This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. In November of 1987 in upstate New York, a 15-year-old girl named Tawana Brawley was found in a plastic garbage bag. She was smeared with dog excrement, her pants burned, and racial slurs were scrawled on her body. Over the next several days, she and her mother gave differing accounts of a terrible incident: rape by several white men, assault for 4 days, and then abandonment in the garbage bag. This apparent racial attack gained widespread attention, but many had doubts about the story. Doctors had found no evidence that Brawley had been raped, and a neighbor claimed she'd watched Brawley crawl into the garbage bag by herself. The case attracted the attention of some prominent blacks in New York City, two lawyers, Alton Maddox and C. Vernon Mason, and the Reverend Al Sharpton. They began to serve as Tawana Brawley's advisors. They told Brawley not to speak about the case, while they created a media circus, holding press conferences and rallies, using the case to attack white society at large for its racism. New York State's district attorney convened a grand jury to investigate the case, and in October of 1988, they concluded that Tawana Brawley had not been sexually assaulted and that there was no evidence that her condition had not been self-inflicted. My guests today are two New York Times reporters, part of a team that covered the Tawana Brawley case, E.R. Shipp and Ralph Blumenthal. They and the other four members of their reporting team have just come out with a book called Outrage, the story behind the Tawana Brawley hoax. Though the New York State grand jury concluded that Brawley's case was a hoax, she's still seen as a victim and as a cause celebre in many parts of the black community. I ask E.R. Shipp why.
Well, for many people in black communities around the United States, Tawana Brawley will always be a victim. Those people will probably never accept our version as the truth because they have been led by people that they respect into believing that Tawana Brawley was indeed kidnapped and assaulted in the manner that they claimed. And for them, I suppose it's more important that this could have happened, whether or not it did indeed happen. And they factor in their own experiences to conclude that, yeah, she probably was assaulted.
This is one of the things that is a cornerstone of Outrage, that the story tuned into a tremendous well of emotion out there. And whether or not it happened the way Tawana Brawley said, it excited memories and fears and tremendous reaction, particularly in the black audience. And that is why we've sort of filtered the story through a group of regulars at a black coffee shop in Brooklyn who see the story through their eyes. And it explains the power that the story had almost as a quintessential myth over so many people, especially blacks.
That's true.
This was Edgar's Food Shop.
Right.
How did you happen to choose Edgar's Food Shop as a place to tap opinion?
Well, it just seemed so right. I was taken to Edgar's Food Shop in Brooklyn by one of the people that we quote in the story, in the book. That's Roy Canton, a custodial engineer at one of the schools. And he wanted me to meet some of his friends who gathered daily to discuss black affairs internationally, nationally, and locally. And in talking to them about the Tawana Brawley case, it became very clear that they represented those points of view that we don't normally hear or see in our coverage of these kinds of cases. These are the real people who kind of absorb all of this and reach their own conclusions, and their conclusions were based on their own personal experiences. Roy Canton had a bad experience with a white police officer who shot at his brother once with a carload of children nearby. Professor Mackey knew all about racism in the South of 50 or 60 years ago, and he knew of white men molesting young black girls. So for him, it was quite plausible. And many of the other people had similar stories to tell. It just seemed very logical to let them represent the common people's points of view for us.
Why did one patron who had doubts about Tawana Brawley's account not want to make them known to his friends at the cafe? Was he afraid that he would be ridiculed or scorned or ostracized for his opinion?
All of those things, I think. It's not the kind of atmosphere in which you feel comfortable voicing an opinion that is not politically correct, in a sense. Everyone who came to the diner and who participated in these kinds of seminars, if you want to call them that, were people that you would consider to be very strong-willed, very much black nationalists in a lot of respects. There were certain things you just did not do. and to appear to be siding with the white authorities, who these people presume to be corrupt and not to have black people's interests at heart, to be seen to be siding with them is to really ask for trouble.
You know, one of the things we point out in Outrage, too, is that blacks and whites have great difficulty today in America talking to each other, talking honestly. The public officials who got dropped this, whose lap this case was dropped, had great difficulty handling it, except with the greatest sensitivity and dexterity. They were afraid of the obvious political backlashes. They didn't want to say, they didn't want to question her account when it was obvious that it was a very questionable account. And again, I think the reason that people at EDCA's kept their doubts to themselves were, again, blacks were afraid of speaking out frankly, whites were afraid of speaking out frankly, and it's a symbol of the racism that is in our society that really is at the heart of this book.
I would think that as a reporter, it would be very difficult to navigate through these waters, that you'd have no sort of sense of bearings when you're dealing with people afraid to speak up, when there are political issues that come in on this, and everybody has their own sort of private agenda.
That's very true. We did find it very difficult as we were reporting this story. And we didn't always agree on to what extent we should trust various of the people we were having to deal with, because we knew of their own agendas, and we might be getting one thing from them in a public posture, but we might be getting entirely different signals elsewhere. So it was very, very difficult.
It was hard to know who was telling the truth, and it was really sort of a five-dimensional chess, because we had our own dynamics in the group. We each came to the story from different perspectives. Not to say that we disagreed radically, because we didn't. We were all journalists, and we all could decide pretty quickly what was important, what wasn't important. But with so much at stake, we had to navigate very, very carefully.
My guests are E.R. Shipp and Ralph Blumenthal, two of the authors, reporters for the New York Times, who've written about the story behind the Tawana Brawley hoax that they covered. How did your team divide its work?
Well, there was so much to do. There was a lot of ground to cover upstate. We divided it up geographically, and when it came to the writing, we sort of broke the story up into pieces.
Was there any division along racial lines amongst the reporting staff?
No, not at all. There were five of us are white men. We have one white woman. That ship was with me.
One white woman.
One black woman. See, it shows that they, you know, we pay no attention to this at all. We all, you know, interviewed different people. Some of us interviewed Al Sharpton for the book. So there was absolutely no division on racial grounds.
Were you all convinced about simultaneously that the Tawana Brawley story was a hoax?
I don't know about simultaneously, but it was a cumulative process. We all went up there, it's important to say, in our initial reporting, convinced, or certainly believing strongly, that this attack had happened. And for critics who say that we fastened on this story because it is a story of a hoax, of an attack against a black person that did not happen, we have to point out that we threw all our resources and the resources of the Times into this story in the beginning, thinking that we were going to recount a real attack, a terrible racial episode that was going unregarded by the local authorities, or indeed even being covered up. It began to be apparent rather quickly that she was not talking, she was not giving an account. And the discrepancies began to multiply. So we didn't all come to the conclusion simultaneously exactly, but pretty quickly we agreed that that the story wasn't right, and there was no member of the team I can recall, can you, Shipp, who said that they believed the story and held out.
Well, we had a few who did. I can think of one person who who did believe the story, and I wanted to believe her story, and I think I was probably one of the last to finally say I have checked everything. I have found no evidence that Tawana Brawley could have been abducted and assaulted in the manner that her advisors were telling us, but I held out a long time.
What was it that finally convinced you that, or that finally allowed you to let go of that hope?
It was after months of working on this story for the newspaper, we had given the advisors, the lawyers, Alton Maddox and Vernon Mason, and the Reverend Al Sharpton, many opportunities to give us any little thing that would point in a direction of confirming that this assault had occurred. And they never, ever came through with anything. That was just in dealing with us. In the legal arena, when they had an opportunity to do something, to explore these issues in court, they totally passed up that opportunity. That was a hearing that was held in Poughkeepsie to determine if Glenda Brawley should be held in contempt of court. That was an ideal time for them to lay out the case, if indeed something had happened to Tawana Brawley, and they did not do that. Then there were other things that they would say to the press and in general to their followers, that they knew who did this to Tawana, that they wanted to see justice done, but nothing that they actually did seemed to lead in that direction. They, to this day, have never gone before any kind of body and said, look, this is who did it, and this is the reason we know that this person did it, and somebody should be punished for assaulting Tawana. They've not done that. So after giving them all these opportunities and seeing that they were not anywhere near wanting a thorough investigation and an exploration of these issues, I just determined there was nothing here to grasp on anymore.
I was struck in this account by the amount of information that your team acquired through sources that chose to become anonymous, including grand jury summaries that provided a great deal of substantiation for the fact that this was probably a hoax. How did you get a hold of the grand jury summaries?
Well, that is a story, Serge, that we tell in Outrage. It was done with a little cloak and dagger stuff. We can't go into a great deal of detail on this. As you can imagine, there was an investigation.
I thought I'd at least ask.
There was an investigation, as a matter of fact, afterwards as to how this material reached us. We would not cooperate, citing our shield guarantees protecting our news-gathering abilities. But I must say that in our long investigation for the Times, we did develop quite a few sources who were eager to get the story out and who saw the frustration that we were going through to tell the story. And I must say that even though we were the truth was dawning on us progressively as we investigated, we felt very inhibited about jumping to a conclusion prematurely, because we always thought, God forbid if we were wrong and there was a part of this that we were missing, and that the lawyers, the advisors were right, and that they did have a piece of evidence that they were holding back, and the New York Times ran a big story calling it a hoax when it turned out not to be, we could just say goodbye to all our careers in journalism. So we had this constant frustration, and at one point, as we tell in the book, I got a call from, I believe we call him a government official, who'd been following the case and said, it's about to come to a conclusion now. The grand jury was about to issue its report, and offered me a chance to talk to him about some of the things the grand jury had found. And through a discussion with this official, who did not give us the summaries, by the way, and I should tell you, the summaries were the background material of the grand jury. It was not sworn material given to the grand jury, and there's some question as to whether this is actually grand jury material. It was material compiled in the course of the investigation, some of which was admitted to the grand jury. It's actually more than came out in the grand jury report. But in the course of this discussion, we learned about the summaries. And as we tell in the book, M.A. Farber, through deep sources of his own, managed to get a copy of these summaries, which laid out the case in even more detail than came out later.
So much of this case was played out in what's called the court of public opinion that in some ways it seems that the Tawana Brawley case may have had a different outcome in public opinion if you had not come across those grand jury results and began casting doubt on the whole account of her story.
Well, I think it is very, very important that we stick to the facts in this case. One of the things that we think we can contribute in our book Outrage is simply the truth. And the truth serves neither black nor white in our view. It is a common ground that we all have to agree on to respect. Because if you get into the business of ignoring the truth, you get onto very, very shaky ground. And one of our characters in Edgar's, in the food shop, through which we filter so much of the story, says, I believe, you cannot combat white racism through black lies, something to that effect. And I think that's a very wise statement.
This actually seems to be an issue that is continuing to crop up in the Marion Barry trial and the Bensonhurst case, where racism becomes an issue rather than facts in a particular case. And I'm wondering how, as reporters, you try to cover these cases.
Well, you try to, as much as possible, to deal with the facts. Often the facts are uncontroverted. There's no doubt in the Marion Barry case, for example, that he smoked some crack in a hotel room. One might, as a reporter, raise questions about the manner in which he was prosecuted, was made a target of a prosecution. That's another subject. But as long as you're focusing on the factual details, I think you're on fairly safe ground. What you want to do is to try to explain how people are interpreting those facts. In the Bensonhurst case, which is now before a jury in New York, originally most people, black and white in New York, it seemed, believed that the defendants were probably guilty. And as the trial has progressed, there's been a strain of opinion being heard in some black media suggesting that maybe the prosecution has the wrong people, that maybe these guys were not guilty. Well, it's important to report that, because whatever the verdict is, there will be some kind of reaction. And if people feel that the wrong defendants are on trial, then that may lead to some, you know, bad consequences. We as journalists have to be aware of that, but we still have to pretty much stick to the facts.
Ship, you said Bensonhurst. You meant Central Park Jarker.
I'm sorry, Central Park when I said Bensonhurst.
Been so many of these cases.
They do run together.
Because in the
Central Park Jarker trial is the one I was describing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, yeah, thank you for clarifying that. In fact, these cases have kind of crossed in a way. I understand that Tawana Brawley and Al Sharpton showed up at the Central Park Jogger trial.
That's true.
This is part of the great, you know, media circus that this case engendered. And it's when I say myth, I was not speaking lightly. This case has now, the Brawley case I'm talking about particularly, has become such a myth that the characters have been elevated to sort of icons, regardless of their real place in the story. And Tawana is going around publicly with Minister Farrakhan and Al Sharpton and the others as a champion of something that bears no relation to what actually happened. And it is really part of the story of our times that these cases assume a mythical proportion out of all proportion to what actually happened. And this is why I think we have to guard against this and stick to the facts and be aware that we're not manipulated, because the tensions that we're dealing with are so raw, and the Brawley case tapped into such a well of frustration that I think, and maybe I'm extreme in this, Shipp can correct me, that I think there were times during this case that we came perilously close to, you know, racial conflict, to a war in the places where the emotions were rubbed the rawest. And I'm talking about Poughkeepsie and Brooklyn. And that is why it's so important to stick to the facts.
One of the media that you excoriate at places in the book is television, as a medium that doesn't spend too much time focusing on the facts, but goes for the raw emotional content, the sound bite. And you refer to television and radio at one point as puppets, following Al Maddox and Al Sharpton going down the street. And wondering how you cope with your colleagues out when you're behind the cameras, when you're behind the scenes as part of a press conference. Do you chide them about the nature of their coverage?
I don't really pay much attention to them. I know that they're going to have to ask, each of the television reporters will have to ask a question so that they will be seen at the news conference in the footage that is being shown. So you'll let them ask their questions. And then if you have any good questions to ask, you save them to after the news conference.
You know, the media played a very, very important part, and not, I think, a very happy part in this whole Tawana Brawley story. The media was to blame for leading the story along byways and paths, again, had no relation to the truth. If you can, and this is one of the incidents we deal with in the book, if you recall people like Sam McLeese, who claimed to have taped Sharpton and the other advisors talking about the case and undermining it. He was put on the air talking about the tapes he had made, yet the station that put him on never heard the tapes beforehand.
Or saw tapes.
And in fact, it appears now there never were tapes. They certainly were never produced, even for the grand jury, and McLeese went to jail for a while until he was acquitted, you can figure that out, for perjury. But the urge to get in the paper or on the air with some development in the story, no matter how irrelevant or how false, drove this case to the extent it did.
And many people formed their basic ideas about the Tawana Brawley affair by what they saw on television. So there are still people who believe some of the things that they saw on television. They believe that Sal McLeese had tapes and that somebody made them disappear, perhaps. They believe that the mafia was involved somehow in the Tawana Brawley business. So they believe all these things because they saw it on television.
You say in the book, the truth is often what people say it is, especially if they say it on television. And you tell the account of a WCBS reporter who went on television and gave a great deal of erroneous information that sort of set in people's minds an attitude about the Tawana Brawley case. How frustrating is this for you as print reporters who tend to then want to take your time?
Well, I was probably the most frustrated of the team throughout this whole thing. At least that's how I felt. I remember time and again practically beating my head against a wall because the facts that we were digging up were not keeping pace with the stories, the false stories that were coming out, but we didn't know they were false, so we had to pursue them. They were fantastic stories, and every time we came close to something, for example, we believed fairly early on that Tawana had not been abducted. And one day there's a big story in the one of the local papers up there that a young boy had seen her being thrown from a car. That suddenly pushed the story into a new realm, and we chased that. Then we found that she'd not been pushed from a car. It just went on and on, and there was no way to keep up, and that was terribly frustrating.
What do you hope to accomplish with this book?
Well, I'll tell you what I think of. I'm often told that this is an ugly story and that it's not a happy story and people don't want to read it. I think we can do a service here by exposing the tensions and the anger and the frustrations that lie beneath the surface and that are often overlooked in this country because we've learned to sort of mask our true feelings and paper things over. But there really is a well of deep anger, certainly in the black community, regarding our criminal justice system. There's a great distrust for public officials. And it comes out in cases like the Tawana Brawley case. And by exposing it and telling America, look, this is what's happening. This attack never happened, but these are the emotions that you're dealing with. You are acting almost as an early warning system and sounding the cry, as did the Kerner Commission report and so many other official reports that have been sort of passed over and not paid attention to wake this country up as to what the real dangers are.
I agree with that, and I also would think, would hope, that especially this would cause more blacks to critically view their leaders and those who would lead them.
Well, E.R. Shipp and Ralph Blumenthal, I want to thank you very much for coming in and being with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking with E.R. Shipp and Ralph Blumenthal, authors of the book Outrage, the story behind the Tawana Brawley hoax. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.